Rachel Cochrane. I'm at Hartlepool Central Library, where I've been working with the writing group here to develop creative work and produce a podcast as part of the Crossing the Tees Book Festival 2015.
It runs from the 3rd to the 20th of June in venues across the region. All the details of times and prices and how to book are available at www.crossingthetees.org or pick up a brochure from your local library.
Bouncing Back, written and read by Chris Robinson. An imaginary rock star returns to his roots on Teesside. We'd had one minor hit in 69. The group broke up. We called them groups back then. They'd called us Geordies. We'd said Tees, not Tyne. They'd not known where, and now they don't know when. I'm not surprised, though, when I count the years, while trying not to count the cost, because to them, when my age was the same as theirs, I must be older than George Formby was. And now I'm stuck on the transporter bridge to jump and show a bungee break my fall. My mind a microwave, my feet a fridge, my cause a charity I can't recall. My only friend a television chap who got my name right on the 6th retake, while 80 new acquaintances may clap routinely, if the bungee doesn't break. They did applaud the last one quite a lot and went on while they disengaged the rope. But then he's just been murdered in the plot of some crime drama, serial or soap. The jumper after me caused quite a buzz when they announced his name an hour ago. He sounds just like the shipping forecast does. I think he runs an all-night phone-in show. It looks as though his fan club's on its way, a crowd of aimless punters looking dim. They've doubtless just awoken for the day. They look at me as if they think I'm him. They say that just before you're really dead, your whole life flashes past and then you're gone. And though I know I'm set to bounce instead, a small amount of flashing's going on. The telechap has just called out my name. I'm quite surprised. He got it right, not wrong. Almost as though he's playing some strange game. Almost as though he knew it all along. Since they've announced me, now's the time, I guess. It's to the edge, and don't look down, and jump, and aha, and oh, and no, and oh, and yes, and bend, and bounce, and up, and down, and bump. And bump? Not bump, another word instead. Not bump. Not bump, but hit. Our minor hit. I'm in the air. They're cheering. I'm not dead. And thousands down below are singing it.
Door, written by Angela Dunn, read by Michelle Burbeck. The door is shabby, uncared for, and not in the best of conditions at all. The old heavy oak is in need of a revarnish, the wood rotten in places, and the iron handle is rusty and stiff. It is set in a weathered stone wall. The grey stones are uneven. The wall is covered in moss, mud and animal matter. It looks and smells revolting if you get too close. Not that I do. I am standing at a safe distance away. The door itself was not easily accessible. It is not particularly tall like you'd think a door would be, but it's not exactly short. An average height for a dull, average old door. There is a tangle of weeds and flowers in front of the door. Mother Nature has been left to her devices, and she's let the meadow grow wild. A variety of greens and yellows and pinks, all vivid against the dark brown and grey background. The most interesting thing to look at in the entire field is the flowers. This place has definitely been abandoned, uncared for, unloved, nature left to do its worst. The weeds grow with reckless abandon. They have not been trampled down, no flowers have been crushed under heavy walking boots needed to access this area. All this suggests no one has been through the door in question, and I was not about to volunteer to do so. Why would I, when I could just walk around the ruined wall? On the other side of the door is probably more of the same. Perhaps it had been connected to a grand building at one time, but now all that remains is ruins. The setting to me is totally uninspiring, plain and decrepit, just like many others I have been dragged to unwillingly. It is neither welcoming nor threatening. In the light of midday, it just looks bleak. There is no sound associated with the door, just the occasional gust of wind or birdsong in the distance. I did not want to come to this door or any of the others. I was made to safely accompany someone who wanted to take many photos of many doors. The country air and flowers set off my hay fever. It makes me sneeze and makes my eyes water. If my companion picks up on my sense of annoyance and boredom, he does not show it. On the way back, we drive past the other side of the door. My suspicions were correct. It is an identical scene on the other side, just another door.
Hijacked. Written by Andrea Illingworth and read by Rachel Cochrane. Surprising her, he wraps his arms around her waist. She takes a sharp breath in surprise. Hijacked, he exclaims laughingly, as he squeezes her tightly to him from behind. He then leaves her at the sink feeling, what? Exhilarated? Shocked? Deliciously aroused? Guilty? Bereft? Anna pulls herself from her ruminating. The concierge is looking at her expectantly. Room 243, please. Anna is stood in the foyer of an aged hotel in London. All dark wood, plush carpets and mock marble. She walks across the dark wood floor to the bank of elevators and presses the button summoning the lift from the fourth floor. An elderly couple join her. They look at Anna and exchange smiles. The lift arrives, golden doors sliding apart. Anna and the couple walk inside. Anna politely inquires which floor and punches in two for the couple and three for herself. Avoiding eye contact with the couple, who are now talking about their day's shopping and planned theatre trip that night, Anna turns her mind to why she is here. Danny had got a contract in London with an IT firm and had suggested Anna come and sample the nightlife. That she wanted to see him again, there was no doubt, and there was that caress of butterflies' wings in her stomach again that accompanied thoughts of Danny. But what to expect when she saw him? Anna knew fine well the reason for him asking her to come visit him. He pretended it was because he was bored and lonely, saying, "If you cared about this lonely old soul in the slightest." She smiled, imagining his expression. Anna knew Danny was checking up on her. Last weekend had been the third anniversary of John's death. She felt she had known him forever, her husband, John's best friend. John had been travelling home on his motorbike, having worked a 9-hour shift at the Hartlepool power station when the accident happened that caused his death. The lift stopped. They had arrived at the second floor and the elderly couple disembarked. Danny had been so supportive over those days, weeks and months. She didn't know how she would have gotten through the funeral without him, which was exactly why she shouldn't be thinking of him this way. A knot of guilt appeared in her stomach, and redness spread across her chest and lingered on her cheeks as she thought how her falling for Danny could be seen as a betrayal to John's memory. No, Anna resolved. Just friends. That's all it can be. Before his move to London 2 months earlier, Danny had been a regular visitor at Anna's, making excuses to check up on her. Anna remembered his health kick. "Right, Anna," he had said. "It's time I got fit, and you're the girl to help me." She had laughed because there was hardly a bean on him. He admonished her. "It's no laughing matter," he said seriously. "Are you going to help me or not?" From then on, they would have regular days out, traversing the northeast and North Yorkshire countryside. The last time she had seen him, before he left to work away, she had cried. And coming over to the chair she was sat in, he knelt and hugged her. Anna flushed now, remembering her heart in her throat as he kissed her slowly, first on her nose and then on her forehead, her eyes closed to receive the kiss. Her stomach clenched as he kissed first one cheek and then the other, then Anna, open-eyed and with parted lips, willed him to kiss her on the lips, but he had just got up and, leaving the room, inquired, "Cup of tea?" Anna followed Danny into the kitchen, and whilst he was reaching for the mugs, grabbed him around the waist from behind, with a voice full of emotion, said, "Hijacked!" Then embarrassed, colour rising to her cheeks, the flush passing down her body, began to pass tea bags and a spoon, the moment over. The lift halted rudely, jolting Anna into the present. She walked out of the lift onto a hallway, and looking to her right, she saw reinforced glass fire doors. Directly opposite, a glossy cream door. Number 237. Left of this, 238. Anna turned left. She knew she would have fun no matter what. She knew Danny cared about her. That was obvious. But did he fancy her? Love her? Want her? Her stomach knotted with anxiety. Of course he's not interested, she laughed bitterly at herself. Otherwise he wouldn't have got me a separate bedroom, would he? As Anna stood on the threshold of door 243, she heard a noise, and looking to the right, saw a cleaner pushing a laundry cart come out of one of the rooms she had already passed. Placing the key in her lock and turning it, she gasped as she heard a familiar voice say, "Hijacked!" And as he hugged her, the door came open and they tumbled laughing into her room.
One Step, written and read by Agnes Frayne. The sense of being pursued by a pack of animals made the hair on the back of his neck stand up. The teenager put on a spurt, forcing his trembling legs up the last few yards of the steep hill. He visualised slavering jaws clamping around his legs. Relieved to finally reach the summit, he eased his rucksack from his chapped shoulders and rubbed his trembling legs. He'd walk for hours over the moor, the majestic building floating like a cloud over the mist-covered hill, drawing him on. Set in the ivy-covered stone wall was a red, pristine door, partially open. He crept forward, then jumped back in shock when birds swooped out of the ivy, flapping and squawking as they flew away. Hunger pushed him towards the door. Now he could see a garden, overlooked by multiple stained glass windows. Noises of pans rattling and the clang of a heavy door heralded the preparation of a meal. A sweet smell of pine trees and lavender soothed his hidden horror. Cowled figures tended the garden. There was a clink of spades when they dislodged small stones. Bees buzzed around the monks, then darted away to dip their heads into open-faced flowers before returning to their hives set against the stone wall. Above the busy noises of life, a silence hovered, pressing down, smothering the monks, throbbing, pulsating. As if parodying a dance, the men worked at their tasks, each face expressing emotions, impatience, scowls, peace, contentment. Words were unnecessary. Did one of these men clamp down nightmares of past terrors? Was his eye searching, always searching for his tormentor? The boy shuffled a few faces, but turned back in despair. God was all-seeing, could see deep into a man's soul. He felt unworthy, without hope. Doomed, he didn't see the monks lined up like crows on a wire, beckoning him in. Blackness covered his heart. The gaunt procession, who floated like ghosts through his filthy home in search of their fix, would have discovered his father, their supplier, trousers unzipped, belly flopping, sprawled next to the stone fireplace, skull smashed,
eyes lifeless. There would be no fatted calf if he returned to that hill. He could run, but his fear would never recede. The distressed boy skirted the wall, then sank to the grass. Behind him, the abbey soundlessly crumbled, the lush garden now a tangle of stone and weeds. No birds twittered. All was quiet. The farmer zoomed up the hill on his quad bike, checking his flock. Sheep were pushing at the sheep lying beside the ruins of the abbey. It was a teenager, curled into a protecting ball. In his hand was an empty pill bottle. His face was smooth, untroubled.
Regression. Written and read by Mary Nightingale Bell. This is a true story. I decided to go for regression, even though I was sceptical of having a past life. I lay on the hard bed. "Close your eyes," he said. "Imagine you see a door." I did that, and a door appeared in a brick wall. "Open it and go through." I did, and I saw me as a child, crying, sitting on the step of a smelly hovel, shivering with cold. A lady came to me, dressed in a dark green crinoline. "Poor little orphan, come with me, and I will feed you and care for you." The lady smelled so clean, whereas I smelled of unclean flesh and dried urine. She took me to her home, burned my smelly clothes, bathed me and clothed me. I was then taken through another door. A large man with bulging muscles was standing behind a bar. He was the landlord. "What have we got here?" "The little orphan I was telling you about." "Jenny, meet Ted Strange, my husband." So she was Mrs. Strange. I was welcomed into their luxurious home. Regular meals and education were given to me. Sadly, Mrs. Strange died. Ted and I were now on our own. By now, I was working in the tavern. With a jug full of ale, I went from table to table, filling men's tankards, and took their money. Then Ted asked me to marry him. I didn't care about the age difference. Age is only a number of years. I learned the tavern was called the Ship. Customers of the Ship were both seamen and farmers. The Ship was almost on the sandy beach. The back of the ship led to a lane surrounded by fields. I saw a mortuary on top of a cliff. I wondered why it was on the top, not at the bottom. The next picture was sitting on a chair in the bar. I was very ill, and Ted had his arms round me, comforting me. The picture disappeared, and I was back. The medium told me that was the end of that life. Years later, I went on a bus trip with a friend to Whitby, calling it Saltburn. It seemed familiar to me, even though I had never been there before. We learned the local was called the Ship. As soon as I entered, I knew it was the place I had been regressed to. One of the rooms was closed. I peered through the window of the door, and there was all the old-fashioned furniture I had seen in the bar. I got my eye on a fireplace. I told my friend that it was 300 years old and pointed to the little barrels I had seen. I pointed to a room and told her that was not there then. It must have been added, and it had been. The people in the room were looking at me as though I was peculiar, as I pointed out where a fireplace had been with rabbit stew suspended in a cauldron. We left the ship, which was almost on the beach. As we crossed the road, my friend pointed out a very old mortuary, which was at the bottom of a cliff, whereas I was sure it had been at the top of a cliff, but it made more sense for it to be at the bottom. This one was made of stone. The mortuary I had seen was made of wood. We got on the bus and continued on our journey. The bus went round the back of the ship, and sure enough we went up a road, not a lane, but evidently the lane had been made into a road. Years later, my son was in Saltburn. He noticed a lot of activity in the distance. He asked what it was all about. Helicopters circling overhead and a lifeboat close inshore. He was told that the cliff was a favourite place for people to commit suicide. He took a photo, and it was the cliff where I had seen the wooden mortuary.
This podcast was sponsored by the Four Library Services and Arts Council England.